This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll begin today with some follow-up on a story we did yesterday about one of the well-known hazards of driving in Boston.
That's right. We reported on a weekend bus crash on Soldiers Field Road that injured 35 passengers, one of whom is still in critical condition. It was just the latest in a long history of accidents in which drivers unfamiliar with the parkways missed those warning signs and crashed their two tall trucks and buses into the low bridges.
That's what happened Saturday when a bus driver carrying students home to Pennsylvania hit the Western Avenue Bridge on Soldiers Field Road. It took crews over an hour to free all the passengers from the wreckage.
And yesterday we spoke with S.J. Port, spokeswoman for the Department of Conservation and Recreation, the state agency that maintains the roadways, about some possible low-tech solutions to avoid crashes in the future. Among the ideas, beefing up those low-hanging warning signs to keep trucks and buses off the parkway.
So in 87, we put cowbells on all of those. Unfortunately, they weren't very efficient. Whenever we had a windy day, they would just clang throughout the entire day, which residents were not thrilled with. So we pulled those off around 1990, and we are looking into what we can do to give further warning beyond the signs that we already have.
The question is, what signs? After he heard this story, Paul Levy did a little investigation of his own, and he followed the course the bus took last Saturday. Levy is the former CEO of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's also taught classes on urban infrastructure at MIT, and he joins us now. Paul Levy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Meghna.
So you followed the route on Soldiers Field Road. What did you find?
Yes, I heard the story on the radio. I happened to be driving in that day, and I followed the route the bus would take, and I discovered that the sign that should have been there, the low-hanging rubber sign that would have indicated the height of the bridge, was not there. So if you're an out-of-town bus driver and it's nighttime and you're tired and you've got a busload full of kids and you're following your GPS, you're just going to turn left onto the road there and hit the abutment, and that's what happened.
So that's at the entrance that the bus driver ostensibly took to get onto Soldiers Field Road near Harvard University. But you kept driving, and what, a mile or so down, there was a sign.
A mile or so down, I got off Sturrow Drive and turned around and looked at the entrance back onto it here at BU, and the sign was in good shape there. So it would not have happened if you had gone in that entrance.
So that's the sign that we saw yesterday when we took the route, because we went westbound instead of eastbound as that's the bus driver was going. So let me ask you, you've written a book called Goal Play, Leadership Lessons from the Soccer Field, and in that book you talk about doing what you phrased as root cause analysis.
Right.
It's something that you were very famous for doing when you were at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. What's the root cause here that you're seeing that's led to possibly this accident and many others on these parkways in Greater Boston?
Well, in fact, DCR has said there's been an uptick in the number of these recently, which I think corresponds to the degradation of the signage. So very often in a case like this, the tendency is to blame the driver. Why didn't he do what he should have done? The fact of the matter is he did what anyone else might have done. And so you look further and you say, what's behind the problem? And here the problem is pretty evident. The signs were missing. Now, why do we know this? Because we go back into the early 1980s when this problem was occurring once a week. Once a week, a truck or bus would crash into one of the River Road underpasses, blocking up traffic all the way back to Watertown. And the police would come out and solve the problem. Bill Geary at the time was the head of the MDC, which ran those roads, and he said, we need a solution. This is bad. And came up with this very, very simple solution of hanging these rubber signs at the height of the underpasses at every single entrance to Memorial Drive, Sturrow Drive, and Soldiers Field Road.
And they went down from once a week, these impacts, to what, once a year?
To less than once a year. Now, the other funny aspect of this, which the DCR person misinterprets as being important, is they also hung cowbells on these signs just in case if you happened to hit one and you didn't hear that, you might hear the bell ringing.
Yeah.
But the cowbells were not the main innovation. It was the rubber signs themselves.
So it seems to be that that there's a potential low-cost solution to something that could be a high impact problem that we have here. But Paul, in your career, I mean, you were formerly the head of the MWRA, right? The Massachusetts
Right.
Water Resources
Authority.
and so you know what it's like to run a major state agency. I'm wondering what insight that gives you into, you know, why or why not DCR might not just be doing the low cost solution of repairing these signs.
Well, agencies always go into their own bureaucratic turmoils and cycles and so on. And sometimes they forget what the easy solutions are. And then sometimes they get defensive. And then sometimes they say, oh, well, we don't have the money to devote to a high-tech solution, and so we can't do anything. I think the thing to remember is even if you're an agency that has budgetary limitations, which they all do, the cost of not having a safe safe conditions is often much higher. Think about the overtime that was just spent on the police department, the fire department, DCR's own staff. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, I would guess, just from this one accident. So let's buy a few rubber signs and solve the problem.
Paul Levy is the author of Goal Play, Leadership Lessons from the Soccer Field. Always great to have you, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I should also say that we did call the Department of Conservation and Recreation for some further clarification and comment on this, but they were not available to comment.
When we sleep, we disconnect from the world and rest, right? Our bedrooms might be dark and warm, and if we're lucky, we float away from the worries of our lives and wake up refreshed. But even in deep, deep sleep, our brains are working hard. In fact, a new review of the latest research just published in the journal Nature Neuroscience finds that sleep plays a big role in consolidating our memories. Sleep helps us sort them, tag them, and divine organizing principles about everything that we take in during our waking hours. Carrie Goldberg, co-host of WBUR's Common Health blog, wrote about this. And Carrie, we've known for a long, long time that sleep is essential to our health, but this overview offers some really fascinating insights into what the brain is doing while we're asleep. Tell us more about this.
Yes, Anthony, it is fascinating. And by the way, did I divine in your introduction that you're longing for a little more sleep than you're getting?
Well, a little baby in the house sometimes might put you in that situation.
It may. Well, and part of what this study underlines is that sleep is so important in so many ways for the functioning of our brains. I would sort of sum it up that it's almost like in your sleep, your brain is doing what you do when you clean off your desk. You're like sorting papers into folders with the relevant labels. You're tagging some things as urgent or semi-urgent, and quite a few things you're actually just throwing away into the trash basket at your feet. Well, it turns out that your brain is doing something very similar with your memories every night as you sleep.
It sounds like work. It sounds exhausting, but in fact, it helps make us able to process what we need to process, right?
That's right. It helps us process and remember. For a while, for example, we've known that if you have an exam tomorrow, at some point you should stop cramming and sleep because that will actually help your performance more than if you just kept cramming. And we've also known that if you sleep on things, your mind will be clearer and more effective in the morning. But there's been just this fascinating research going on for years about what exactly your brain is doing and how your sleep affects your memories.
Well, Carrie, you interviewed one of the authors of this overview, Dr. Robert Stickgold of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School. He's a leading researcher on sleep and memory, and he joins us now to tell us a little more about this. And Dr. Stickgold, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be here.
So say a little more about what Carrie was describing. How does this filing process work? How does our brain sort of sort through and file and make sense of these memories?
Carrie was absolutely right that the brain is choosing which memories to save and which to discard. It's choosing where to file them and how to file them. But it's actually doing more than that. It's also deciding how to process it, what part of a memory is worth keeping and what part isn't.
The idea, you know, Carrie brought up this idea of the wisdom of cramming and cramming and cramming for an exam and knowing when to sort of shut down and go to sleep. So it sounds like when we're asleep, the brain can really do more for us than when we're awake at a certain point.
There's some folk wisdom about it, too. My father, I remember 50 years ago telling me that when he was in law school, he would study for an exam, and he would be up late at night just cramming one case after another into his brain. He said he would go to sleep with them all a jumble in his mind, and when he woke up in the morning, they were all filed away just the way they were supposed to. So the brain creates organization out of the information that we take in as well.
So is there an explanation? Let me give you a personal anecdote that I lived many, many times. As a reporter, working late at night, finishing a script, I knew it had to be in the morning, and I'd be working late. And at a certain point, I just am not functioning efficiently. I'm not getting to the points that I want to make. I go to sleep, I wake up, and suddenly the rest of the story just flows out of me in less than an hour. Is that because something has happened other than just I'm rested? I mean, it's more complicated than that.
Just rest isn't enough. What you really need is sleep. And in fact, not only does it flow out in an hour, you know, we would argue that much of it is being written while you're asleep.
That See, you that's wake amazing.
Up and, and you know what the story is. You know how it goes. And again, it's sleeping on a problem. It's that same phenomenon where you go to bed with some major, you know, do you take that great job in a lousy city or do you stay put? And you go to bed with just this jumble of information in your mind. And you wake up in the morning and the decision is made. You wake up and you say, I got to take the job. And you can't even explain why, but your brain has done that calculation, and you know it's right.
So, Carrie, you made reference to the fact that I live in a household with a small child, right? And we've as parents, we've both seen what happens when a toddler needs a nap.
Oh, yes, we have. And in fact, it can be quite scary when a toddler needs a nap. But why does a toddler need a nap? Why is it that the younger a child is, the more sleep they need? And this work raises the suggestion that it is because they're learning so much about the world around them. They need to be divining the rules and the relationships of everything around them. And so they have to have more sleep in order to do that. It's not just that they get tired.
What's interesting about children as opposed to adults is when we learn new data, we sort of say, oh, okay, so sleep does this too. Or, oh, so memory comes in this flavor too. And we sort of put it into the sleep folder and we put it into the memory folder. Young kids don't even have those folders yet. And so they're doing a much more complicated type of learning. They're figuring out first principles.
I have one last question, Doctor. A colleague of yours at Harvard, Dan Schachter, said that memory is really about the future and not about the past. What does he mean by that?
Well, you know, when we think about memories, we think about sitting in the chair in our living room and remembering that time we went to the beach with the kids and what a great time we had. And we think of it as reminiscing, and we think of memory as thinking about the past. But evolutionarily, memory is about helping us know what to do in the future. So if you're sitting there and reminiscing about the beach and you remember how last summer your daughter, who's 8, decided she could swim out to the raft, and guess what? She couldn't. So someone had to go rushing out and pull her out of the water because she was floundering halfway out there. That's not so that you can reminisce it so that next summer when she says, Dad, can I swim out to the raft? You can just look at her and say, duh, no. I mean, you almost drowned last time. And that's what memory is really about. And so what we want to do is decide to remember and to file things away in a way that's most useful for the future.
Anthony, I call this the will this be on the test question.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And as Carrie and I agreed yesterday, you know, the test is your whole life.
Well, it's so fascinating. Dr. Robert Stickold of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School. He's the co-author of a new overview of research on sleep and memory in the journal Nature Neuroscience. Dr. Stickold, thanks so much for joining us.
Anthony, it was a pleasure.
And Carrie Goldberg, co-host of WBUR's Common Health blog. And by the way, you can find a link to her recent post at radioboston.org. Thanks for being with us, Carrie.
My pleasure, Anthony.
Coming up, we take a closer look at the cybercrimes law used to prosecute the late internet activist Aaron Swartz. Is it hopelessly out of date? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.